The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, December 29th, 2010. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report, and we are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an amazing show for you today. I mean, just if there's ever going to be a better example of the highbrow, lowbrow quality of this program, I don't think today will ever be rivaled. As you know, I have been subbing for Keith Olbermann on Countdown in the evening for the past two nights. Some of you who were listening to the program yesterday know that during Monday night, I thought I was going to have a heart attack in the middle of the show. And it turned out to be just gas. Turned out to be a tremendous... it wasn't like I stopped the show. They were all sort of surprised to hear this. But about halfway through the show on Monday, I started feeling this like pressure in my chest. And it felt like I had to burp, and I couldn't burp. And it occurred to me that I was about to have a heart attack on live television. And then, of course, my mind went to immediately to trying to calculate how many hits on YouTube that would get. And assuming that if I was actually to make it through, I mean, you know, you have a heart attack right there. I'm a young man. I assume there must be some medical personnel somewhere in 30 Rock. And I like to think that I would have made it and still also gotten the YouTube. Then, of course, the other scenario was that I have the heart attack during the break, and one of the guys working the crew has to step out in front of the desk, and that's the YouTube, which is almost more interesting in some ways. All right, but be that as it may, it turns out I think I ate something. And I am still struggling with this. Now, I was dealing with it last night. It's much easier to deal with gas when you know you're not having a heart attack, when it's just gas. But I am now I have now taken to the prune juice. So it's possible I may not even make it through this broadcast. That's the that's the highbrow stuff of today's program. I got confused. That's the lowbrow stuff. Usually it's quite a thin line here. And in a couple minutes, we're going to be talking to Ezra Klein of The Washington Post, because we are going to have what I think could be the weediest conversation. The most weedy? Am I saying this correctly? The wonkiest conversation possible about the filibuster. And about filibuster reform. Because the way that filibuster reform has been talked about on television is not quite accurate. Because the reforms that they're suggesting are, in fact, they're not in any way making it harder, per se, to filibuster. Well, maybe that's arguable. But really what it is it's more about transparency. If you really want to stop a bill from being voted upon, essentially, by not invoking cloture, which is when you end the debate on a bill, these reforms would force it to be more public and to make sure that the people who are doing that are associated with that move rather than sort of just a general level of GOP obstructionism. There's no way to really put any political pressure on that as the Democrat, or certainly not for the Democrats. So we'll be talking to Ezra Klein a little bit later in the program. I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, because we rarely get guests in this studio, be that as it, call it what you will. But today, in studio, I'll tell you something. This show, aside from you and your membership subscriptions, which you can subscribe to at majority.fm, you get a lot of good swag, you support the show, you make it possible. Besides your donations, it's what allowed us to buy the Mac Mini. We would not be broadcasting now if it wasn't for that Mac Mini. And, you know, besides the Sinclair, which was sent to us by its namesake, there is one individual who, without whom none of this would have been even remotely possible. I would still be I'd be spending all my time tweeting right now. And that's it. There would be no broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, in studio with us, Kyle Shank. And I'll tell you something, that's not my 360. Kyle travels around with his own troop of fanfare guys. Kyle is a, what do you do? Are you like a software programmer extraordinaire or what? Yeah, you know, you're not familiar with the microphone.
Yeah, software engineer.
Software engineer, right. There you go, folks. Software engineer. Let me tell you something. The geek quotient in this office is rather high. Although I did bring up Star Wars, but Dorsey knew what I was talking about immediately. Yeah, you get to turn on the mic, too. Geek quotient's high. The knowledge of talking into mics and turning on mics, a little bit low. Folks, I live in New York City. There is one potential threat to this show continuing that I must be forthright with you about. The show is broadcast from New York City, and all of a sudden, you know, we have, as far as I know, perfectly legally rented this office. But as you know, I spend most of my time reading WorldNet News Daily. World News Daily? WorldNet, what is it? WorldNet News Daily? Which actually, you know, it's that Joseph Farah. And wasn't he one of the big birthers? Dorsey, is your mic working? Dorsey's mic is not working. Someone unplug it? What? Do you run out of batteries? Well, you ran out of batteries, maybe, in the microphone. Well, we need to get a new cable. But this guy was, he was one of the guys who started the birther meme. Is that right, Dorsey?
Yes.
Okay, well, you can just talk to me directly, and I will repeat what you said. Yes. He said yes. Joseph Farah, now, apparently, and this is going to be the next one. I mean, I'm telling you. There is nothing too crazy for these people to believe. That Governor Abercrombie from Hawaii, he could personally go to every American's house, knock on their door, spend the rest of his life literally walking door to door with the original copy of Obama's birth certificate. And the theories would just move from there is no birth certificate to they forged the birth certificate to Abercrombie is not really a human being. He's a Cylon. He was developed in a lab by Walt Disney, who is cryogenically frozen, whatever it is. And then they will develop an entire political movement around it. And then the Republicans will take advantage of it. You know, the really incredibly offensive thing about the birther movement is not that there's nut jobs out there who will believe that, because there's nut jobs who will believe anything. What's incredibly offensive is that there is not a single leader of the Republican Party. I guess McCain said it during the campaign, but there's not one of them who will stand out and unequivocally say, this is wrong, let's move past this, he's an American citizen. They won't do it. They will take their political capital where they find it, and if it means nurturing it, they will nurture it. So the latest is, on December 16th, President Obama announced that the U.S. would reverse itself and now support the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People.
Huh. Interesting. We better dig into this. What does this mean? He's going to support the rights of indigenous people. They're tapping the lines now. The declaration was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2007. But the U.S. under President Bush opposed it. Well, that's not terribly shocking. What was that thing that he had? It was like somebody once asked him, like, what is your definition of sovereignty? Sovereignty is like a nation that has a sovereign nation has sovereignty. That's when you're sovereign. That's what it is. It was a hilarious clip. We should try and dig that up just for old time's sakes. And now Obama has decided to support this resolution. And of course, in saying so, he said the aspirations it affirms, including the respect for institutions and rich cultures of native peoples, are ones we must always seek to fulfill. The State Department says while the declaration is not legally binding, it carries considerable moral and political force. Interesting. However, there is an Article 26. You don't have my computer on. Let's try that again. I said there's an Article 26. Indigenous people have the right to lands, territories, and resources which they have traditionally owned, occupied, or otherwise used or acquired. Number two, indigenous people have the right to own, use, develop, and control the lands and territories and resources that they possess by reason of traditional ownership. Three, states shall give legal recognition and protection to these lands, territories, and resources. Do you realize what this means, ladies and gentlemen? WorldNet Daily asked the obvious question, is Obama to give Manhattan back to Native Americans? The article describes how President Obama is voicing support for a UN resolution that could accomplish something as radical as relinquishing some of U.S. sovereignty and opening a path for the return of ancient tribal lands to American Indians, including even parts of Manhattan. The article continues, Obama's interest is personal. He noted during the 2008 presidential campaign he was officially adopted by the Crow Nation, an Indian tribe in Montana, and was given an Indian name. Joseph Farah, the founder and editor of WorldNet Daily, followed up on the article. Truth be told, I have a fair amount of Indian heritage on my mother's side. I will take Manhattan. I suspect Obama himself plans to cash in on this action. It's fucking unbelievable. And you know what's really unbelievable? These people control the country. All right. We'll be right back. We'll be talking to Ezra Klein. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, Ezra Klein from the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Ezra.
Thank you.
Assume you're pretty tan.
Sorry?
I assume you're pretty tan right now.
A little bit. Florida was warmer than Washington, but not quite as warm as you might think.
Did you run into Chris Christie down there?
I did not. We must have missed it. I mean, unfortunately, unlike Governor Christie, I was actually working from Florida, so I spent most of my time inside writing about American politics. I didn't get to go to Disney World.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but maybe,
yeah, me too.
maybe if there's some type of hurricane that hits New Jersey, he'll take you.
Well, it seems good being a government worker sometimes.
Yes. Wasn't he also the guy? He also, as a U.S. attorney, he spent a lot of time at like the Ritz-Carlton, if I remember correctly.
That I don't know about.
But all right, well, listen, I want to talk to you basically about the filibuster, and I have warned my audience that this could get pretty weedy and wonky here. So don't hold
weedy and wonky.
Weedy and wonky. I mean, it's Wednesday. It's in the middle of everybody's vacation. So this is a great time to do it. First, let's just outline what it is that is being proposed. Let's just say all the returning Democratic senators, and including a couple that weren't, everyone essentially except for Chris Dodd, signed a letter to Harry Reid asking him to reform the rules around the filibuster. Just give us a quick breakdown of what they're proposing.
Nothing. They are proposing nothing. They signed a letter to Harry Reid saying you should, in some way that we are not going to define, reform the filibuster. And the reason they did that is that there is a belief and an understanding that the practice has been increasingly abused, and it really, really has, in ways that are completely, completely ahistorical. And we can talk about that later. But they signed the letter to give him essentially negotiating power. So he can go to Mitch McConnell and he can say, look, I got, 53 Democrats. I got more than a majority of Democrats here ready to reform this thing if you guys don't back off a bit. So I think the likeliest thing to expect is this is, broadly speaking, a warning shot. Democrats will make some small changes to it. Maybe, when you vote to break a filibuster, it's something called cloture, and you need to essentially take a couple of days to do that. Maybe they'll make that period shorter. There'll be very, very small changes, if any are made at all. But what Democrats are saying is, if you guys keep doing this, we're going to reform this thing. We're going to, if not get rid of it, change it pretty dramatically. I don't think they're going to do it this session, but they are saying this is not a sacrosanct principle. We can reform it. It's been reformed before, and if you guys keep doing this, we're going to do it again.
All right. So now there are a lot of people out there advocating for some real changes, and the plan that's being floated around is that the time to do this would be on the opening day of the Senate, I guess on January 5th of 2011. Some of the proposals that I've seen floated around have to do with which part of the process, as a bill sort of makes its way to the floor, you can attempt to filibuster, and just how sort of anonymously you can do it. There's some requirements that after 10 hours there needs to be 20 people on the floor, after 30 hours,
right,
so on like that, and then another transparency issue in terms of these holds.
So the problem with the filibuster, and the reason these conversations get weedy, is you have to ask yourself which problem you're actually solving. So the main thing the filibuster is doing right now is creating an effective 60-vote hurdle for anything in the Senate to get done. None of these reforms do anything about that, and that's an important point. They don't bring it down to 57 or 55, much less 51. The filibuster remains a 60-vote supermajority requirement in the U.S. Senate, which is not how the place was designed to work and is not how it's worked really at any previous time in the nation's history. So put that aside for a minute. Then there's a second series of problems. One problem is that breaking a filibuster takes a lot of time. So on something like healthcare reform, where it's a really big deal, it's okay to take a couple weeks to do that. That is how you run the Senate. But on something like a judicial nomination or a food safety bill, those are not as big issues. And so the prospect of having to take a week or even more than a week of very, very valuable, very precious floor time to break a filibuster being mounted by two guys or 10 guys or even, or even just the Republican Party as a whole, even if you have the votes to break it, it may not be worth it. So a lot of things simply slip off the calendar because what the filibuster does is, essentially throw molasses on the U.S. Senate. This doesn't really do anything about that either. What it does do something about is that the filibuster currently is not what we think of when we think of a filibuster. It doesn't require anybody to sit on the floor of the Senate and talk. So you're not dealing with the type of filibuster where you're essentially running an endurance test. If the Republicans want to filibuster something, they pretty much just tell Harry Reid, we're going to do it, and Harry decides if he's got the votes or not, and if he doesn't, he doesn't bring the thing up, and if he does, he tries to move it and decides if he's willing to risk the time. What the Merkley reforms would do, which is one of the options on the table for this, and probably the one I think you're talking about, is that it would make it much more physically costly on the Republicans to filibuster. So they would have to be eventually 20 of them on the floor at all times, and they would have to be talking continuously. And essentially, if Harry Reid wanted it to be so, all day and all night. So they'd have to decide, you know, how much is this worth to me? Do I really care about killing this judicial nominee who, frankly, isn't that controversial in the first place? Maybe they do, but maybe they all want to go home for Christmas, or maybe they all want to go home at the end of the day. And as we saw in The Lame Duck, when people want to go home for Christmas or they want to go home at the end of the day, suddenly obstruction doesn't look as good as it did before.
Right.
So you're solving one of the problems here, but I do want to be clear, and I think it's important. It isn't any of the main two.
Now, I spoke to Senator Tom Udall the other night on Countdown, and also accidentally called him Udall, which is just a side note. But he's been talking about the constitutional option.
Mm-hmm.
And if my understanding is correct, what this means is essentially they would attempt to change the rules. My understanding is that you can change the rules with 51 votes in the Senate, but that the question is, can you break essentially a filibuster of that vote with less than 2/3? Is that right?
Yeah, right. So you can't filibuster, you know, this constitutional option idea. And here's the reason. By the way, there's an argument that you could just change rules at any time with 51, but we can put that aside for a minute. You can't filibuster what happens at the beginning of a session for this reason. At the beginning of a session, there are no rules. So every Congress, in the Constitution it says, every Congress or both chambers, whatever the wording is, will be able to make their own rules. And that means that each new Congress has to be able to make its own rules, right? The fact that in 1952 the Congress had these rules, that can't affect the Congress of 2010, because that would mean that the 112th Congress doesn't have the capacity to make its own rules. So when you come in, essentially what happens is you agree to adopt the rules of the previous Congress. But you don't have to do that. And if you're not doing that, then the only rules that are really operative are those that are in the Constitution. And the Constitution has nothing about a filibuster. It says, you know, you can't do treaties and you can't do impeachment with less than 2/3. And it, you know, it says you can't overturn the president's veto with less than 2/3. But it does not say that you cannot run your votes in a majority rules environment. That was what the Senate was intended to do. And so unless the rule book is readopted, the Senate doesn't work that way. So when the rule book does get readopted, it's a majority vote, and Democrats could simply vote to change the rule book.
Yeah. Now there's two issues with this. One, the letter that Reid has in his pocket now as a negotiation tool becomes a lot less effective once the rules are adopted and the reforms to the filibuster have not been addressed. Isn't that right?
Right.
Okay. Now, two, my understanding is that there's also a concept that has essentially prevented the type of rules change that we're sort of discussing here, that the Senate, as opposed to the House, is a sort of continuing body. Because only 1/3 of the Senate, everyone knows that the House, all of its members are up for re-election every 2 years. It's essentially a new body every 2 years. The Senate, on the other hand, only 1/3 of its members are up in any given election, more or less. And that there is a concept, or at least a Senate tradition, that this is a continuous body, and that it would be rather precedent-setting to do what some people are talking about, either getting rid of the filibuster or reforming it in this way.
Well, address that,
because I know that when
sure.
we were talking about the nuclear option back when Bill Frist was threatening it so that judges couldn't be filibustered, there was a whole question about the vice president coming in as the president of the Senate, and maybe it was because it was 50-51 at that time, but essentially ruling on the constitutionality or asking the parliamentarian to rule on the rules and then basically saying, hey, if you didn't like his rules, go take a powder for a minute.
And that's exactly the point right there. So there is the continuous body theory, but it's exactly that. It is an abstract theory. It is one way of understanding the way the Senate usually works, because the Senate usually doesn't make a huge deal out of bringing in the rules, and you can say they don't even do anything. They just sort of, you know, they quietly accept them. So they're continuing. They're not making any decisions. But we have done, I mean, rule changes have happened again and again, sometimes in with this sort of constitutional option framework. That's happened before with the filibuster. You know, remember, before 1975, to take out a filibuster, you needed two-thirds of the Senate, not three-fifths. They changed it. Before 1917, you couldn't end a filibuster at all. It simply wasn't in the rules anywhere that you could get rid of unlimited debate. They changed that. So rule changes do happen, and as the nuclear option, which was a much more aggressive version of this theory, sort of showed, if the majority has the, you know, has both sort of the presidency of the Senate with the vice president and the will to do this, they can sort of do whatever they want. I mean, they can really, and that's what was my point earlier, that you don't even really need to do it at the start of a session. The reason the constitutional option gets pushed is because on some level, I believe, it strikes people as more fair. It, you're not changing the rules in the middle of the game. You're changing them and making it clear before the game. You know, Tom, or Senator Udall makes the argument, I think it's very, very persuasive, that it would be a good thing for the Senate in a general sense not to just think of the constitutional option as something it should do this year because, you know, the filibuster has gotten out of hand, but something it should be doing continuously. Every 2 years, you should be looking at the rules again. And the reason he says that is that it brings accountability to the way people use the rules. If you have a rule book that never gets changed at all, people basically are just sitting around all day trying to figure out how to game it, trying to reinterpret parliamentary procedures in order to get their ends done. That isn't how rules should work, right? Rules aren't weapons. They're supposed to be pretty clear, a pretty clear framework under which, you know, ordinary business can take place effectively. So if every 2 years people are looking at these rules and saying, well, are these working for us now, that it would create a much, bring back some of those norms of being careful with how you use the rules, because you understand if you misuse them, the majority can take them away from you. But so, more directly to your question, I'm not too worried about the continuous body thing, because basically, you know, the power exists for the majority to do what they would like to do.
But, okay, there's 2 points here. Now, let's leave aside the question of sort of some notion of fairness and small d democracy in the Senate. Okay, let's leave that aside for a second. Let's talk about this politically, because you mentioned that the filibuster threshold went from 67 to 60 with Senator Byrd back in the 70s, and in 1917 was the imposition of a way to break a filibuster. But my understanding is that at these times, these were negotiated changes in the rules. That, in fact, it didn't ultimately come down to a showdown, as it were. That it was, in fact, a negotiated, almost bipartisan change in the rules. And I guess what I'm concerned with, because there's two, and I'm talking now from a political sense. Again, putting aside the idea of the Senate should be a more democratic body, we can have that debate too. But what I'm concerned with is A, that I'm not clear on what political benefit we can get from a democratic perspective with any of these rule changes, whatever it was. If the filibuster's dropped to 55, I'm not convinced that there's a benefit for Democrats. And B, my concern is that if this is a fundamental change in the rules, if we were to adopt that perspective that Merkley has, that every 2 years the rules can be rewritten, what is to prevent the Republicans from coming in 2012, they control the Senate. It's, you know, at least statistically, it's likely to happen, but who knows what can happen in 2 years. What is to prevent the Republicans from coming in and saying, hey, you know those rules that the House passed this year on cut-go, where only taxes can be dropped and anything else, any other expenditures must be paid for by other cuts? We're going to impose the same thing. I mean, what's to prevent them from doing that?
Well, number one, I would expect they would do that one way or the other. The PAYGO thing comes in and out of the Senate. Remember, Republicans got rid of PAYGO when they controlled the Senate in the aughts. So that's been a more sort of, or a less negotiated rule change in general. But your broader point here is, of course, right. You know, nothing will prevent a determined Republican majority, as they almost did with the judicial filibuster, from changing the rules. And you have to ask yourself if you're okay with that. My answer is that I am. My broad point on the filibuster, the reason I don't like it fundamentally, is that I think that the problems we face as a country going forward are on autopilot and the solutions are not. That rising health care costs and crumbling infrastructure and global warming and all these things, if we do nothing, they will continue to get worse and worse and worse and potentially consume us. But if you want to do something about them, what you have to ask yourself is, should it be easier or harder to take action legislatively? And I think we need to make it easier. Now, so what people say is, well, if the Republicans come in and they say, look, Democrats have already started taking out the filibuster, we'll just finish this off, and we and, you know, President Mitt Romney or whoever it might be, we'll just do whatever we want. I think you've got to say on some level, fine. You know, if they decide to do that, and they decide to pass a bunch of legislation, then the way things are supposed to work in this country is that the American people will judge that, decide if they like it, and either return them to power or not. I'm a big fan of the health care reform bill, as I think you know. And so some of my readers will say to me, you know, if you get rid of the filibuster and Republicans sweep in 2012, doesn't that make it much easier to repeal health care reform? And my answer to them always is absolutely, and that if, frankly, after passing health care reform, so much as I might like it, if Republicans win two straight elections at a very, very high level and the bill remains unpopular, legislation isn't it's not the Ten Commandments. This stuff has to be undoable, and at some level, we do have to sort of respect the democratic nature of the country. So I'm much more comfortable with a political system in which the way we are judging the parties is that they ran on an agenda, they achieved that agenda, and we decide if we like it, rather than they ran our agenda, achieved nothing. Nobody really understood why Washington didn't work for them, and now there's a sort of a question in the country of why these people aren't working on their behalf. I think that the clear lines of accountability you need to make a democracy work effectively have been broken down by the level of minority obstruction on both sides, by the way, in the Senate. And getting rid of that would lead to a better country, even if it means that there would be things that the Republican Party, or for that matter, the Democratic Party, would do that I might not like.
Okay. Well, there's 3 points here. One is the inevitability of Republicans changing it anyways, and you know, it's very hard to predict these things. My concern with doing anything that's precedent setting, which it seems to me that it would be on some level if it's not negotiated, is that the Republicans have a certain I was using this analogy yesterday, where the Republicans have a certain capacity. If you think about it as a horse race, they have a capacity to jump 4 feet. Their horse can go over a horse jump of 4 feet, whereas the Democrats are probably around 2 feet. And that if we set a precedent here, we're lowering their ability to change from 5 feet, a 5 foot jump, down to a 3.5 foot jump. So their capacity hasn't increased, but the threshold has dropped enough so that they can get through it. Now, if I hear you correctly, that's sort of irrelevant in the argument you're making. The argument you're making is, let the Republicans, if it's their will to come in and do this, and the American public supports their doing this, then let the chips fall where they may. That's what a democracy is about. Is that accurate?
I think that's right, although I'm slightly confused by the horse jumping analogy. But the only thing I would add is that I think the best thing for both parties, and I've made this argument many times before, but nobody in the Senate listens to me, would be for essentially the two parties to get together and create a package of rule changes that would take effect in 6 years, which would mean both parties have to think simultaneously as potential minorities and potential majorities.
Right. That's a great idea, of course. But
broadly speaking,
they can't agree on anything else. But I guess my concern is in what you're suggesting is that there's two things. One, the Senate wasn't necessarily built. I mean, I think the level of dysfunction in the Senate has reached an all-time high. But on some level, your own argument would support that it should, because they keep electing Republicans who are obstructing in this instance. I mean, the Senate was, you know, the Senate when it was first established was actually appointed by state legislatures.
Here's what I always think when I say that, when I hear this argument, because it makes perfect sense, right? The idea that the American people want obstruction. And I would sort of suggest that I don't really see the case for it. The Pew did a poll recently, and they said, how many you know, how many people know what the filibuster essentially is? 25% of people knew that you needed 60 votes to end a filibuster. 25% thought you needed 51%, and another 50% didn't know.
Right.
So there's A, I think it's really important to put this clearly. Most Americans not only do not pay attention to politics, really, but really don't pay attention to congressional procedure. So they look over and they basically see nothing happen, and what does happen takes forever, and it's incredibly bitter and partisan, and it just looks awful to them. And they don't really totally see why that's happening. I mean, they're not sitting here, you know, reading CRS reports on institutional
right.
rule changes in the Senate. And so they sort of are continually throwing out the other party, right? We've had, after about 40 years of stability in the House during, you know, from about the 60s to the 90s, or 50s to the 90s, you have had three or certainly a number of changes back and forth in the House, and similarly the Senate has been changing hands very
right.
rapidly. And you've entered, I think, a period of essentially disequilibrium in American elections. And I think part of the reason, not the only reason, but part of the reason is the filibuster that the two parties have recognized, and this wasn't something they used to do, that the quickest way back to power is to make the majority party into a failure. And the way you do that is you keep them from governing. So you keep them from governing, and that's you doing it. But the American people look and they say, these guys aren't governing. I mean, it's just crap what's happening up there. And, you know, we're going to throw them out and get the other guys in. And I don't think that's a healthy way for democracy to work.
But aren't you concerned that frankly, you know, I don't know how much people follow politics, regardless of whether it's procedure or not. I mean, you know, we're looking at you could go around and ask people about CutGo, and they would, or even PayGo, and
sure.
they would assume you're talking about some Indonesian country or something. It wouldn't mean anything. And I guess my concern with this is just that from a I appreciate the fact that you're looking at it from a procedural standpoint. I'm just, you know, I look at what happened with the lame duck session. And what I see there was when the Democrats can work the politics as a majority, they can get things done. To the extent that other things are not happening, it's a failure of politics. Or it's a failure for us to understand what their agendas are.
I think that's a common take on the lame duck, but I think I'd say I disagree with it. And here's how I'd re-spin it, or here's how I'd reframe it. When I look at the lame duck, what I see was this. There were a series of bills. The tax deal obviously was negotiated right before the lame duck and was sort of a different case, so we'll put that aside just for a moment. START, the food safety bill, the DADT, these were a series of bills that in every case, and that was really important, most of them needed unanimous consent, although not all of them, in every case, they had some level of pre-existing Republican support. And these were bills that had been around for a long time in the 111th Congress, but they hadn't been passed. And here, to me, is the reason why. Before the election, Republicans had a very strong incentive to not give the Democrats any victories at all. Now, that was true even if they thought the food safety bill, for instance, or Don't Ask, Don't Tell, was the right thing to do for the country. That above that priority was the priority that the country, you know, to put it in the most virtuous possible way, the country would be better off if we were in charge because we have better ideas for the country. So even if DADT repeal is a good thing, it's a better thing to basically make sure Democrats don't look like they're being able to govern the country, and we'll stop them from doing that. Then lame duck happens, and now you don't have an election imminent, particularly you don't have an election imminent with the same people from this Congress. And a lot of these Republicans, I think, who knew this legislation was good legislation, wanted to get it done still and weren't sure they'd actually be able to get it done given the radicalism of the incoming Republican Congress. So I know it's a lot of my progressive friends have made the argument that what happened lame duck is Democrats got way better at messaging. And I don't really see the evidence for that. What seems to me to have happened to lame duck is that there were things that needed to get done, Republicans who wanted to do them, and Harry Reid is pretty good at saying he's going to keep the Senate in session longer than people wanted to, so a bunch of stuff slipped through. But I actually think it's evidence for my point that given the current incentives in the system, the two parties choose making each other into failures over governing for the good of the nation, and that the reason they're able to make that choice, the only reason it is an effective strategy, is because of the filibuster and sort of assorted similar types of obstructions in the Senate. And so if you take that away, that I actually believe, and this is a bit of a counterintuitive argument, but I think it's true, that bipartisanship on bills would increase, because when simply saying no isn't the best thing to do. It doesn't work because the other guys don't fail. They just succeed and you weren't part of it. It's not a very good political strategy. When the START treaty ended up passing, there was an interesting thing that happened where a treaty that barely looked like it was going to get 67 ended up getting many more than that. And the reason that happened is that for Republicans or for the minority in general, the best thing to do may be to block something from happening, but the second best thing to do may not be to vote no, particularly if it's fairly popular. So I would push you to think of the lame duck a little bit like that, which is that
right.
It is what happens when the basic incentive that the filibuster creates is for a brief moment lifted.
And finally, what about judges? I mean, my other concern is that in 2012, this Republicans take over the Senate. Let's say it is President Romney or President Thune. And Democrats don't have an ability to filibuster judges.
This sounds a little bit cavalier, but you've got to win elections. And it's true that when a Republican wins and there's a Republican Senate with them, they will be able to get in a lot of fairly extreme judges. On the other hand, they were able to do that last time too. As you remember, the attempt to take basically the compromise was that, okay, we'll just stop filibustering your
right.
judges.
Exactly.
And on the other hand, Barack Obama has had a ton of his judges, people like Goodwin Liu, held up. So, again, the way I'd put it is that, you know, you'll see something of a parity of the two parties. And if you believe that your ideas are stronger and are going to be more popular and your party is going to be stronger and more popular than the other party, it's a change you should welcome, because basically the way it might work, or the way in theory it should work, is that you'll get to do the stuff you said you were going to do, people will like it, and they'll keep electing you. You know, one thing you made the point earlier that it can go both ways, saying that the public doesn't know congressional arcana. But I think the thing to think about of a filibuster-less 111th Congress, aside from things like the public option, which would be in the bill, and that sort of thing, is there would have been a lot more stimulus. I mean, the House passed hundreds of billions of dollars more stimulus than the Senate did. And that money would have been out of the economy helping people, and it may very well have moderated the Democrats' electoral losses, because at the end of the day, the economy is what people vote on. So, I mean, that capacity to show people that your ideas work and the other guy's ideas don't is, I think, you know, really should be the central – should be – everybody on both sides of the divide should be confident about it. And if you're not confident about it, you should ask yourself why you're on the team that you're on.
I mean, I guess, you know, my sense of the stimulus may also have to do with my sense of the stimulus is that if you had dropped the threshold for a filibuster to 55, there would have been senators who have recalibrated where they stood on the whole thing so that they could still be the fulcrum. You know, I mean, I think Joe Lieberman was a perfect example of that when it came to the buy into Medicare, where the guy championed that position. And when he realized, like, this is going to put him a little bit on one side of that fulcrum, he's still not going to be the guy, that he shifted his position so that he could be that guy again.
Sure.
But I guess I'm a little concerned about the idea of the protecting the minority from the tyranny of the majority to some extent if we lose that entire capacity. But I don't know.
Well, the point I'd make on Lieberman and the filibuster is that he was able to do that because he needed 60. If you needed 51, you'd have had 9 votes to play with there and better deals you could have cut. As for the question of stimulus and you know, you see a drop in Senate support for that, again, I think the strongest incentives nowadays are party incentives, right? Almost everything depends on – you can predict pretty much any vote by looking at party. And if you have a situation in which you have the stimulus money coming through and Democrats know it would be good for them to pass and Republicans know it would be bad, he got 60 Democrats, yeah, Ben Nelson may take a walk because finally Ben Nelson is able to take a walk and you don't need him. But most of your people are going to be there for you on that vote. And it's what you see in the House. I mean, that is how it works. And you know, you can just see in the level of legislation the House is able to pass versus the Senate, you know, how much people do sort of stick together on these party votes. As for the tyranny of the majority and the minority, it's completely fair enough. But I do think I would put it this way. Britain and Canada and the Netherlands and all these other countries, they work on majority vote rules. And when we do elections, they work on majority vote rules. And for most of our history, the Senate and the House worked on majority vote rules. There's this great paper that Lyndon Johnson's Senate head, his Senate liaison, sent him, where he said, you know, after the 64 election, we got 55 votes, so we can pass Medicare. You know, you'd never say that today, but that's how things worked back then. You could have passed Medicare with 55 votes. It was a pretty big bill. So a world where you have majority voting rules, I think we get sort of weirdly concerned about it at this point because we've got a bit of a bias towards the status quo in the Senate. But I'm, as I said earlier, I think the real dangers in the sort of coming decades are not that we will do too much on our pressing problems, but that we'll do too little. And if you believe that, and again, as I do, then you have to say the Senate is part, or the filibuster is part of what will make us do too little. So I worry less about the tyranny of the majority than I do about the impotence of the majority, and particularly the impotence of our legislative system going forward.
Well, Ezra Klein of the Washington Post, I appreciate your time. I hope that when the Republicans get in, they will heed your call to do some stuff about our infrastructure, about our...
Sure.
I'm not terribly hopeful, but I appreciate your indulging us, which I think is probably one of the... It's got to have been one of the weediest... I think definitely in this week's podcast that are floating out there, this one is going to be the weediest on the filibuster.
And, I get weedier twice before breakfast.
Oh, gosh. All right, Ezra Klein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to take a break, and I'll be back in just a minute, and I will start to take your IMs. Yeah, that's what we'll do. We'll start to take the IMs a little bit early today so that I can hit the head by 1:15. I'm pounding prune juice. You can see that on the Sammy Cam as we speak. We'll be right back. You can IM me. Oh, I should turn on my IM. You can IM me at Majority FM or all the other old IM addresses you have for me. All right, I'll talk to you soon. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. I will take your IMs at Majority FM. I know I just turned it on, so it may be a little bit tricky. I got a couple more stories here. You know, I don't know if I'm convinced on the filibuster stuff. I just... I know that it would make the Senate more Democratic, small d, Democratic. But, you know, when we talk about the lack of... When we talk about the dysfunction of the Senate, I think in some respects this process argument is simply an excuse of the Democrats from their inability to marshal their political forces. And so, in some respects... I'm not convinced that it's not democratic in the sense that it enhances the power of the status quo. And it does so because you need to be a millionaire to be in the Senate. Not every senator is a millionaire. But literally that's the best you can say. Not every senator is a millionaire. There's a problem with having to say that. There's a problem with having to say that you need millions of dollars
to run for the Senate. And so necessarily the people who end up representing their constituents are not necessarily representing those constituents who elected them in office. And I think the filibuster, at the end of the day, is a more valuable tool to the disenfranchised than it is to the establishment. And to the extent that the Democrats have not been able to crack the code of the Republicans, God knows what would happen without a filibuster, or without even, you know, without. I mean, I have no problem with the reforms that Jeff Merkley's talking about, but my understanding, and I'm not seeing this addressed, and I don't think Ezra quite answered this question. If it takes an unprecedented move, and by unprecedented, it hasn't happened before. There have been rule changes. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the method in which the rules are changed. All of the rule changes that Ezra cited in the past were done through negotiations. And if you change a rule in an unprecedented fashion, and you don't need to go back to the vice president to rule on the constitutionality of setting up the rules on that first day of the Senate in 2011 or 2013, and you're the Republicans, let's say, in 2013, you don't need to go to Joe Biden. You just change them. Like Ezra said, nobody pays attention to procedure. And then all of a sudden, 51 votes, every program, the Department of Education is gone. You know what I mean? You know, it's that type of shit. And I think I have a sense that this is another technical policy expert response to a political problem, and that scares me, because you cannot simply look at the procedure of the Senate and divorce it from the politics so easily. You just can't. Particularly in the Senate. These guys are douchebags. I mean, the stories I hear. The stories about, like, Roland Burris. Now, of course, you know, Roland Burris, sort of a weird guy. But the stories you hear from like staffers who have worked in the Senate about the way, like, they treated this guy like he's the loser in the back of high school class, you know, with skid marks on his pants. Seriously, literally. And you just think to yourself, like, holy shit, this is the most powerful deliberative body per capita in the world. I mean, per person. And they function like, you know, like the group of guys that we would sit in the back of class at Doherty High School in 10th grade, and, you know, when the teacher's back was turned to write on the chalkboard, and they're like, "Cack!" I don't even know what it meant. Hamp! Because guys went to Hampton Beach. I mean, this is, you know... Yeah, it sounds retarded, sophomore, because we were sophomores and we were retarded. But that's the way the Senate works. And on some level, what it will take to change this rule on day one essentially means there are only rules that exist for 2 years, period. And the establishment of the Democratic Party, or I should say, the Democrats who are part of the establishment, I'm not worried about them going in and making draconian changes. And I don't think they're worried about it, because the Republicans will just do it.
This is the type of thing that, like, it scares me a little bit, because we have a dysfunction not procedurally in this country, but in the body politic. I don't think this is going to make them more accountable. I mean, in some respects, Ezra's argument of, like, well, if the Republicans come in there and they trash everything, it's up to the electorate. Well, you know, that was also the, that was almost, that's almost, I mean, frankly, that's almost, what I hear when I hear that is exactly sort of the argument that some Nader supporters would argue. Hey, man, if we let George Bush get in there, American public is going to wise up. Right? I mean, am I wrong about that? There's echoes in that argument. It presumes a political body, a political, a functioning political system in this country that I don't know that we have in terms of accountability, in terms of a media that's actually sort of like genuinely informing people as to what's going on. And so I'm, you know, I'm a little late to this, to this argument, but I it's a little bit, I'm a little bit nervous. But you know, one of the it's so far beyond my ability, sphere of influence, and really many of us. I mean, you know, this is not something like there's a movement afoot. You know. It's not something like Credo says, reform, you know, I think it's there, it's amongst wonks. And I, frankly, I haven't seen too many people, not in public anyways, even question the wisdom of this on the left. So, I don't know, it's a little bit disturbing. Let's go to the IMs, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, wait a second, I'm sorry. We have some breaking news, ladies and gentlemen, from our post-apocalyptic entertainment reporter, Dorsey Shaw. Dorsey, what do we have? You have some breaking news.
Thanks, Sam. Yes, Ashton Kutcher is preparing for Armageddon.
Oh, do tell.
He is training for the apocalypse.
Oh, hold on. Okay, go ahead.
He told Men's Fitness that he thinks that the end of days is on its way, and he wants to be prepared for the inevitable madness. So he's doing Bikram yoga, buying guns, and training with some Thai boxing.
Oh, Jesus. Seriously? And we just spent all that fucking time on the filibuster? We should have done that report up front, dude, because then we wouldn't even have to add that whole filibuster conversation.
Here, I'll give you a little taste. People don't have maps anymore when the apocalypse comes. People use their iPhones, GPS systems. If there's no electricity, nobody has maps. That was one of the quotes.
Well, you know, I mean, I have to admit that I have a box full of encyclopedias, and from when I was a kid. And Nikki's like, what are we doing with those? Let's get rid of those. And I'm like, well, no. I mean, we should have a set of encyclopedias. Like, I know Milo will never use them, except for, like, one day when she's, like, 17, she'll be like, oh, this is cool, and then cut them up for an art project because it'll be kitschy. But I do in the back of my mind. I'm like, well, look, it's two boxes. You know, prior to 20 years ago, this is basically the most contained sort of digest form of the world's knowledge. You know, what the fuck? It's worth keeping more than that goddamn, you know, monogram picture that we got for our wedding or something.
And you can keep them right next to your stockpile of ammunition.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, you can use them if people are shooting at you. You use them as, like, sandbags.
Yeah.
But, you know, solar storms, if there's a solar storm, right? Kyle, what do you do? If there's a solar storm, is there some type of surge protection we need, or what do we do?
I'm out of work, so that'd be, That'd be terrible for me.
Right, it would be bad for
I think
you.
For myself. About myself first. Yeah, now, I think you should invest in a giant megaphone.
Well, I'm looking for a ham radio, folks. We'll get it up on the blog. It's could it go back to radio, right? I mean, I just need a solar powered radio, and
I'll just sit here and like crank a big generator the whole time.
I'm not completely unconcerned about the solar storms, but we don't need to. Oh, geez, I thought one was starting. It turned out to be Dorsey rubbing his hat against the mic. Gotta love Kenny Mack. Gotta love Fox talking smack about Michael Vick. I thought giving a second chance to despicable felons, washed up beauty contest, and failed TV weather guys was pretty much in their mission statement. Hey, you know, that whole Michael Vick story was, we did it on Countdown, more about how the right's getting upset about it. Those clips were hilarious of the Fox people. I never watch Fox anymore. I used to watch Fox all the time. It's just like, you dip it back into that, and you're just like, seriously? Really? This is, wow. Like, Tucker Carlson, so desperate, man. That dude has become so desperate. One of the things I used to like about him, just as an individual, is that he never had that level of desperation. But I guess he's getting older. I mean, listen, I appreciate, I understand where desperation comes from. Folks, you can become a Majority Report member at majority.fm. It's either that, or I'm going to have to start pulling shit like Tucker Carlson and start calling for random people to be assassinated. Did he call for like the death penalty for Michael Vick?
Yeah, he said he should be executed. He should have been.
Now, of course, he's being facetious, right? I mean,
he's being a dick,
right? It's just so nakedly desperate for attention. I understand there are dog lovers out there. Listen, I have two cats that are barn cats that my daughter thinks are her brothers, literally. And if anything happened to those cats, someday when we're completely set up, we'll layer on the cat can. and you folks can see this like ongoing saga I've had for over a year now in building contraptions to care for these cats. And literally, there are nights where I literally cannot sleep, worried that what happens if something happens to these cats. So I appreciate that, and I had a dog as a kid. But, you know, somewhere between pit bull fighting, killing dogs, and the killing of 100,000 civilians in Iraq, right? If you sort of follow that spectrum from we killed 100,000 civilians in Iraq, and then yeah, you want to move laterally, you can move laterally if you want to see this, it's vertically, whatever. If you're going to call for the execution of Michael Vick, you don't have enough electricity, chemicals, rope, firing squads to kill everyone else who is at least as morally culpable in the world. Just in our society. So he can't, he's just doing it in the same way that, like, I don't know. I mean, it's really no different than, somebody on, well, I was going to say Dancing with Stars, but he was on Dancing with Stars. I mean, it's really no different to, like, you go on Dancing with Stars and you're just like, yeah, I'm going to drop my pants and moon it alive. You know, just like it's that pathetic. How? The best was Steve Ducey or one of those guys on the
Ducey
on the Fox and Friends was like, I can't believe that we're almost a year and a couple of days anniversary of the underwear bomber, And Obama doesn't mention that, but he calls the Philadelphia Eagles. What?
Never forget the underwear bomber.
Never forget that almost sometime around now, a year ago, there was a guy whose underwear caught on fire on a plane. The notion that this, I don't even know America anymore if we're not talking about that a year later. Fucking. And then his guest host turns to the camera with this very serious look. Was this unpresidential? We want to hear from you at our poll. I can't, you know, Fox is going to be much more enjoyable when they actually work in the penile enlargement advertisements into the actual content, where it's at, where it's just literally integrated.
They're not already doing that?
No, not quite. Was President Obama being presidential from the vantage point of someone who may not have quite as much manhood as he likes? Go to Fox.com, take the poll, and check out our 10% coupon for male enhancement pills. Optimal Tomato. Hi, Sam. I think the reason you want to preserve the filibuster for a GOP-controlled Senate is for Dems to use it as last resort. Correct. The last Congress proved there is no such thing as a last resort anymore. You may be pining for a bygone age. Perhaps. I just don't, you know, that, well, can anybody name me? And first of all, look, Ezra is significantly more intelligent than I am. But I don't agree with his perception that the stimulus would have been larger if there was, and I could have gotten into an argument about this, but I held him longer than I had told him, that there would have been larger if there was no filibuster. Excuse me? As far as I can tell, we got exactly what Obama proposed. Now, you could say, well, Obama knew there would be a filibuster. Really? He was told that. And everybody in the Senate told me there was no way this could get through. That's what Jonathan Alter would say. Well, look, you know what? That's unprovable. Because, you know, it's like saying, like, hey, Dorsey, get in your car, man. We're going to play chicken. You're going to take your car at one end of the road. I'm going to take the other. We're going to drive right at each other. And you just look at me and you go, I'm not going to stop, man. And I go, all right, let's not do it. Fair enough. You know, you really don't know until the rubber meets the road, folks. Aside from all the other subsidiary arguments that it would have been better to ask for more so you could get more later, this idea that somehow Obama couldn't have gotten more because of the potential for a filibuster, it's I'm sorry. You're a reporter and some Senate staffer told you this? Hey, there's two theories you can go on. One is they're telling me exactly what they're going to do. This is their exact game plan, no matter what happens. Or two, hey, they're trying to have a desired outcome, and it's advantageous for them to tell me, a reporter, that we're determined to do something, and that will help that situation arise, and they won't have to make that decision. That's the other potential scenario there, right? When Jonathan Alter sits down with the Harry Reid's chiefs of staff, and they say, this is the way it is, Jonathan Alter doesn't go, maybe I'm a tool to achieve that goal. No, it's, I really have this guy's confidence. And good thing for me, I know what it is. And then, of course, from Alter's perspective, I'm bringing up Alter because I had this argument with him on Rattigan. From Alter's perspective, he now must believe there's no way there was any other agenda behind that staffer's telling me this. Because that would then diminish him. And that's not even necessarily a conscious thing. Nobody likes to think they got played. Nobody likes to think that they're a tool in a larger machine. But I think it's naive to assume, frankly, that I did some reporting, and there was no way that wouldn't have been filibustered if it was $1 trillion. No way. You don't think there's any chance they told you that just so that they wouldn't have to make that tough vote? Nope. Nope, that's not what it says in my book. Kyle, did you just raise your hand?
Yeah, I have a comment. I found a news article that you might like. Do you have a news effect on your 360 over there?
Do I have a news effect?
Judith Miller joins Newsmax.
Newsmax? Are you fucking serious? Wait, they're like WorldNet Daily, aren't they?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm literally... Where was that in?
Slate. Dave Weigel.
Oh, man. I think it is the apocalypse.
You should have seen Matt Cooper on Hardball yesterday. Matthews is just like, he can do anything. He's the greatest. You know how he does that? He kind of like...
Yeah, who, yeah, about...
Matt Cooper. Wasn't he...
Cooper wasn't really quite as culpable in that situation as Judith Miller, no. Moreover, since the topic has been brought up that all ensures the next GOP Senate majority will gut the filibuster at first chance anyways. Well... No, they can't. Here's the point, Optimal Tomatoes. They can't do it if Biden is vice president in 2012, which I would say statistically the odds are he will be. The Republicans can't gut the filibuster because what they will need, they can't gut the filibuster unless these reforms are made in the way that they're talking about making them. You understand that, like, what will happen is, and this gets a little bit arcane here, but they will meet on that first day. They will create the rules. The Senate chair, the vice president, the president of the Senate, will have to rule that you do not need two-thirds to end the debate on these rules, because there's no rules that exist. Now, Ezra talks about it like that's just the way it is, but that's not the way the Senate has functioned. But once the president of the Senate makes that rule, that this is a new Senate every time, this is not a continuing body, like it's been denoted, as far as I know, every 2 years, then the Republicans will not need to come back to that situation. It makes it harder. It's a higher hurdle unless the Democrats lower that hurdle. And for what benefit? What benefit? Bush and Chains, hey, Sam, can you see me? Pat Robertson, snow is God's way of punishing Americans who are planning to drive to do something gay. Is that true? Is that true? Did that really come out like that? If you have a link for that, send it. I think progress. Henry Kissinger's long history of complicity in human rights abuses. Have you seen the activist movement crash J.P. Morgan, buy silver? If not, Google it. Who sponsors that? Silver Sellers of America?
Silver Line.
Silver Line. Allstate used sampling to confirm BOFA countrywide lied about virtually everything when selling mortgages. Palin emailed Bush and Chains. Send me these as links at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Majority follower. The problem isn't the filibuster. The problem has been the Democratic majority leaders. Don't you remember the theater performance when Reed made them all pull out the cots and order pizza because he was going to make them all actual filibuster and bring back the troops from July 2007? We still have troops in Iraq. It's true, although Maliki said they're out in 2011. He's holding firm to that. It's not easy to do this politically, but there's a lot more movement on this than just about anything else, frankly. I, Johnny, if the filibuster is reformed, then at least it will be harder for Senate Dems to disguise their corporatism. That's true.
That's true.
That's true, but they won't have to. But you know how they're going to hide it in the next 2 years? Can't get it through the House. Don't be a putz. Keep in mind, Sam, the Senate is already anti-democratic in that it's not representative of two senators per state. The majority of Americans are represented by only 20 senators. Yes, I agree. I agree. That's the point, is that the Senate was not set up to be such a democratic body. And you can't make necessarily one part of it more democratic and get more democracy out of it. In other words, making it 51 to 50, you know, making it a 50 vote, 51 majority doesn't necessarily make it more democratic, particularly when you consider that that 50 could be made up of states that don't constitute half the country. I just think it's a slippery slope, and frankly, maybe I'm too partisan, but I don't see the benefit to Democrats, or I should say maybe I'm too ideological. I don't see the benefit to progressives. You're wrong on this, Sam. Senate rules are not laws. They're just rules, like in a country club. The only law is that the majority makes the rules. As I said, the way the Senate is composed is the way the minority is protected, and the VP has nothing to do with it. Well, don't be a putz. I understand the Senate rules are not laws. I'm saying if you can point me to a time where the Senate changed its rules by as a function of a ruling from the chair that the Senate is not a continuing body, send me that precedent. Because I think that is what's going to happen if they make this change. And then it's going to be something that they're never going to have to revisit. Republicans will do whatever they had to do. They passed the Bush tax cuts with 50. Well, yes, they did it through reconciliation, which was certainly an option for a lot of shit that the Democrats just didn't do. So this is not a question of procedural. Reconciliation deals with anything to do with taxes or anything to do with revenue to the government. So it's a different function. It's about will. Yes, I agree, don't be a putz. I agree. It is about will. Be that as it may, please remember my horse jumping analogy. The Republicans have more will than Democrats, but they don't necessarily have the will to open up this Pandora's box. They didn't do it before. They can threaten it. But let's say they do it in 2012, okay? And the Democrats don't do it now. Let's say it's inevitable that the Republicans are going to do it. Name me one benefit, one piece of legislation, one iota of benefit the Democrats are going to get in the next 2 years. One. One. If it is true, as everybody keeps telling me, Ezra, they're going to do it anyways. Don't be a putz. They're going to do it anyways. Well, then your argument must be. Come on in. Hi. Can I help you? I'm sorry? Oh, no, thank you. Yeah, no, we don't drink water here. Appreciate it. Sorry, folks. We had a guy selling us water. Name me one thing that's going to be accomplished in the next 2 years by this change. And if the answer is zero, then let the Republicans do it. Let this be their fight. Doesn't make sense to me. Chesapeake 88. Is it me or is it Charles Krauthammer now in love with Barack Obama? Do you really think Obama will go after cutting Social Security? Wouldn't that rip the Democratic Party apart? Yes. Yes. It depends how much we fight back, but I think it's possible that he's going to try. Spaff, my big worry is they could pass laws or put judges in who would make it impossible for us to ever get back into the majority. Yes. I agree. I mean, look, we've already seen it with the Supreme Court, right? I mean, Citizens United, essentially, more or less at this point, maybe there's some wiggle room, someone will find it, but more or less sort of guarantees that money is going to be the dominant factor, period. Maybe it's always been that way, but the degree in which this is going to be dominant is just, oh. Love the Weatherman skit on Countdown last night. Yes, I got to tell you, that was one of the funnest things I've done in a long time. Gravitune, we need non-PayPal options. Okay, I'm working on that. I haven't had time, but I think I've figured out a situation. But I may need Kyle's help a little bit. It'll be easy, though, because it's almost like, it's easy.
It's like selling water.
So, yeah, it's like selling water, dude. All you do is you're not going to die. We got one less water.
The best part is that he looked around and decided that, hey, there's a show going on here.
Right.
I can still sell this water.
Yeah.
No, I don't think he had it. I don't think he couldn't have, like, possibly, like, there's no, I'm sorry. When people walk in and they're just like, there's a guy there. He's sitting there. They're all sitting at desks. See if they have microphones. What?
That's how he talks to his staff.
Yeah. That's what I do. I hit the microphone. Evan, would you come over here for a minute, please? Thanks.
I'll be right there, sir.
And listen, hold my calls. the fucking hair. Well, first of all, let me say this about the Weatherman thing. I had so much fun doing that. Do you realize, like, while I was, we pre-taped that, obviously, because you could see us both on screen.
What?
But I was like, this is amazing. I will never, it is impossible. It is impossible to do something that is more like a weatherman without actually being a weatherman. Probably, there's no other way to do more weatherman, be like more like a weatherman without actually being a weatherman. I mean, I'm in Rockefeller Center. I think I'm probably like literally one floor above where Al Roker does his weather. I'm in front of a screen. I'm making all the gestures. I'm looking out over the Rockefeller Center tree. And I'm doing a weather bit. Only a weatherman would do more weather stuff than that.
Is this like a lifelong goal of yours?
Well, it's just fun to do stuff that, like, I mean, it sort of brought out, like, the thing that why I like to be an actor.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, hey, I can be a weatherman without actually having to be a weatherman. For, like a minute, I was a weatherman. Like, I still, like, I did a really crappy sitcom called On Call 16 years ago. And I still remember the part where I played a doctor, a surgeon. And I still remember performing the laparoscopic cholecystectomy with trocars, and it was, I'm in full surgical gear and I'm looking up like there's a real laparoscopic cholecystectomy going on. How fucking awesome is that?
It's pretty great.
I can't tell you, I think I did that in like 96. I can't tell you anything that happened from like 90s, probably after that moment until probably sometime last week. I don't have any memories of that, but I do remember that laparoscopic cholecystectomy. It was fun. Loving you on Countdown, who combed your hair? Yeah, last night, it's when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When you're a hairdresser, you gotta, it was a little bit, I think I might try and go for a little bit more natural look. Which is almost identical to this look. It's just not as... You need Rachel's stylist. You're making me feel a little self-conscious. I'm happy now. Survival Kittis series in the Cedar household. Sounds like, Survival Kitty. Mirella, 62. Agree, Ezra Klein is very smart, but I think he's a little deluded, i.e. not realistic. He doesn't seem to acknowledge the political reality of this new breed of Republicans. Maybe it comes from working at Washington Post. There's a lingering bubble hanging around you. You brought your comedic self. The Weatherman skit reminds me of the Daily Show style. That was good, Sam. Oh, thank you. I agree with you about, I think there is a tendency of people who are sort of policy advocates to be, to just sort of not weigh the politics as much as they should be weighed. And, you know, again, if you're a hammer, everything's a nail. And if you are a great policy thinker and you have that type of mind, necessarily, you know, politics become screws. If you're the hammer, nail,
horses.
Horse jumps.
Mark Green says, I just got hired as an executive producer for Ring of Fire starting next year. It's going to be great with working you again, Sam. Tell your listeners, Ring of Fire 2.0 is back to 2011.
Yep. Oh, that's a good one. I remember when I put out my first email blast, and I said, like, for, I can't remember if it was Sam Cedar's show or what, but I said, like, Sam Cedar 3.77 is about to launch. We've just come out of beta. We were stuck in 3.76 for a long time. But you're going to love Cedar 3.77A. Armageddon, great job on countdown. Keeping with the important topics of the day, for the gaseous heart attack, by try Nature's Ways Pepogest, peppermint oil pills. It's not a paid endorsement. And before going on air, the Brat Diet, bananas, rice, applesauce, or toast, no more dollar pizzas. How hands-on do you get to be on countdown? Oh, how hands-on do you get to be on countdown? Selecting guest topics, copywritten. I suggest guests for certain segments. Dave Dayan, I suggested. Pethukas, I suggested. That first night. You know, Reich, but they go to Reich regularly. I'm moderately hands-on. I mean, the problem is it's Keith's show, and so, you know, they know Keith's show better than I know Keith's show. Happy now. I can swallow. I just have a lot of gas. And it's just like what I was trying to do was burp, and I couldn't burp. And just in the middle of the show, I was like, what's going on? Oh, my God, I'm having a heart attack. And then, like, just like on cue, you know, I had water onto the left. And every time I would pick up the water cup, my heart like this, and I'd have to take it to my right. And I'm like, what is going on? Because I think I convinced myself that I was having a heart attack, that I was, like, over, like, am I getting numbness? That's, like, the worst thing in the world when you're trying to read a teleprompter and thinking in the back, like, half your brain is reading, and the other half is going like, I'm having a heart attack. It's much easier when you're reading, and your brain is going like, I'm not having a heart attack, but shit, man, you have gas. Invasion. What effect does the 24-hour news cycle have on the political pendulum swinging from left to right in every election cycle? The Republicans also have more... Have a little more bully pulpits. Was it Arrowhead? That's good water. I think the 24-hour news cycle probably has a lot. But, you know, again, it's like a political thing. I mean, this is the weird thing. It's like, I just don't understand how the theory that, like, Americans aren't savvy enough to know that the political parties are trying to prohibit, you know, trying to make them look bad to knock them out of office. But they are savvy enough to know that they're getting screwed by a certain party. I just... No. Kenny Mack. Okay, wait. Sorry, let's see. Oh. You are right. There is no benefit to modifying the filibuster with a GOP House. You swayed me completely, Sammy.
Are you serious? That was quick. But yeah, there is no benefit. There's a weird audio thing happening with your mic. You sound like the aliens on V. PayPal options. Look up Bitcoin. Bitcoin. Well, I'll look it up. Laughed my ass off on that weatherman thing. No wonder they won't let you on the Maddow show without your glasses. They couldn't tell you two apart. Sam, do you still have your precious metal ETFs? If so, you're probably loving life right now. No, I went through a period of liquidation, deleveraging. Is there more of a problem with smaller states like Montana have the same amount of power as California in the Senate? Should we really ask about reforming how the Senate is made up? Well, that ain't going to happen. Will you be hosting Countdown tonight? Yes, I will be, which is why I have to say Bark Beatles? Yeah, that's a good point. Don't be Putz is referring to that weather scientist. My wife says you need to blink more, says Harold. Okay. Oh, good, Ultimate Tomatoes. All right, guys, got to go. It is time. Tomorrow, we will have a best of. Friday, we will have a best of. Monday, we will be here live. Kicking in the new year. Folks, have a great, great, great new year. Safe. Don't drive drunk. Oh, there you go. I got a book. We will see in 2011 all sorts of new things planned. Not for right when 2011 starts, but as 2011 rolls out. Have a great week.